There is no subjectivity as to whether a transaction is confirmed in Bitcoin's blockchain. It's just math. For a deep dive on cryptography, we highly recommend The Code Book, The Science of Secrecy from Ancient Egypt to Quantum Cryptography by Simon Singh. Immutable. The combination of globally distributed computers that can cryptographically verify transactions and the building of Bitcoin's blockchain leads to an immutable database, meaning the computers building Bitcoin's blockchain can only do so in an append-only fashion. Append-only means that information can only be added to Bitcoin's blockchain over time, but cannot be deleted. An audit trail etched in digital granite. Once information is confirmed in Bitcoin's blockchain, it's permanent and cannot be erased. Immutability is a rare feature in a digital world where things can easily be erased, and it will likely become an increasingly valuable attribute for Bitcoin over time. Proof of work. While the previous three attributes are valuable, none of them is inherently new. Proof of work, POW, ties together the concepts of a distributed cryptographic and immutable database, and is how the distributed computers agree on which group of transactions will be appended to Bitcoin's blockchain next. Put another way, POW specifically deals with how transactions are grouped in blocks, and how those blocks are chained together to make Bitcoin's blockchain. The computers, or miners as they're called, use POW to compete with one another to get the privilege to add blocks of transactions to Bitcoin's blockchain, which is how transactions are confirmed. Each time miners add a block, they get paid in Bitcoin for doing so, which is why they choose to compete in the first place. Competition for a financial reward is also what keeps Bitcoin's blockchain secure. If any ill-motivated actors wanted to change Bitcoin's blockchain, they would need to compete with all the other miners distributed globally who have in total invested hundreds of millions of dollars into the machinery necessary to perform POW. The miners compete by searching for the solution to a cryptographic puzzle that will allow them to add a block of transactions to Bitcoin's blockchain. The solution to this cryptographic puzzle involves combining four variables: the time, summary of the proposed transactions, the identity of the previous block, and a variable called the nonce. The nonce is a random number that, when combined with the other three variables via what is called a cryptographic hash function, results in an output that fits a difficult criteria. The difficulty of meeting this criteria is defined by a parameter that is adjusted dynamically, so that one miner finds a solution to this mathematical puzzle roughly every 10 minutes. If all of this seems like drinking water out of a fire hose, that's okay. It's that way for everyone at the outset. We'll cover this process in greater detail in Chapter 4, and then go even deeper in Chapter 14. The most important part of the POW process is that one of the four variables is the identity of the previous block, which includes when that block was created, its set of transactions, the identity of the block before that, and the block's nonce. If innovative investors keep following this logic, they will realize that this links every single block in Bitcoin's blockchain together. As a result, no information in any past block, even if it was created years ago, can be changed without changing all of the blocks after it. Such a change would be rejected by the distributed set of miners. And this property is what makes Bitcoin's blockchain and the transactions therein immutable. Miners are economically rewarded for creating a new block with a transaction that grants them newly minted Bitcoin, called a Coinbase transaction, as well as fees for each transaction. The Coinbase transaction is also what slowly releases new Bitcoin into the money supply. But more on that later. A useful analogy for Bitcoin's ecosystem. To tie everything together using an analogy that will prepare us for a discussion of the applications of blockchain technology in Chapter 3, it's helpful to think of the concepts as a stack of hardware, software, applications, and users in relation to a personal computer. The miners that build Bitcoin's blockchain with the POW process are the hardware, just as a MacBook Pro provides the hardware for a personal computer. That hardware runs an operating system, OS. In the case of Bitcoin, the operating system is the open-source software that facilitates everything described earlier. This software is developed by a volunteer group of developers, just as Linux, the operating system that underlies much of the cloud, is maintained by a volunteer group of developers. On top of this hardware and operating system combination are applications, just as Safari is an application that runs on an Apple operating system. The application's interface with the Bitcoin operating system, which pushes and pulls information to and from Bitcoin's blockchain as needed. Lastly, there are the end users that interface with the applications, and someday may have no concept of the hardware or software underneath because all they need to know is how to navigate the applications. Private versus public blockchains. Broadly, there are two types of entities that can own the hardware supporting blockchains, public and private. The difference between public and private blockchains is similar to that between the Internet and intranets. The Internet is a public resource. Anyone can tap into it. There's no gatekeeper. Intranets, on the other hand, are walled gardens used by companies or consortiums to transmit private information. Public blockchains are analogous to the Internet, whereas private blockchains are like intranets. While both are useful today, there's little debate that the Internet has created orders of magnitude more value than intranets. This is despite vociferous proclamations by incumbents in the 1980s and 1990s that the public Internet could never be trusted. History is on the side of public networks, and while history doesn't repeat, it does often rhyme. The important distinction boils down to how the entities get access to the network. Remember, a blockchain is created by a distributed system of computers that uses cryptography and a consensus process to keep the members of the community in sync. A blockchain is useless in isolation. One might as well use a centralized database. The community of computers building a blockchain can either be public or private, commonly referred to as permissionless or permissioned. Public systems are ones like Bitcoin, where anyone with the right hardware and software can connect to the network and access the information therein. There is no bouncer checking IDs at the door. Rather, participation in the network forms an economic equilibrium in which entities will buy more hardware to take part in building Bitcoin's blockchain if they feel they can make money doing so. Other examples of public blockchains include Ethereum, Litecoin, Monero, Zcash, and so on, which will be discussed in more detail in chapters 4 and 5. Private systems, on the other hand, employ a bouncer at the door. Only entities that have the proper permissions can become part of the network. These private systems came about after Bitcoin did, when enterprises and businesses realized they liked the utility of Bitcoin's blockchain, but weren't comfortable or legally allowed to be as open with the information propagated among public entities. These private blockchains have thus far been most widely embraced by the financial services as a means to update IT architecture that hasn't had a major facelift since preparation for the Y2K bug. Within financial services, these private blockchains are largely solutions by incumbents in a fight to remain incumbents. While there is merit to many of these solutions, some claim the greatest revolution has been getting large and secretive entities to work together, sharing information and best practices, which will ultimately lower the cost of services to the end consumer. We believe that over time, the implementation of private blockchains will erode the position held by centralized powerhouses because of the tendency toward open networks. In other words, it's a foot in the door for further decentralization and the use of public blockchains. The potential applications of private blockchains extend far beyond the financial services industry. Banks and other monetary intermediaries have most quickly moved to adopt the technology because the use cases are most obvious for a system that specializes in securing transactions. Beyond the financial services industry, others that are exploring the applications of blockchain technology include the music industry, real estate, insurance, healthcare, networking, polling, supply chains, charities, gun tracking, law enforcement, governments, and more. Throughout this book, we will focus on public blockchains and their native assets, or what we will define as crypto assets, because we believe this is where the greatest opportunity awaits the innovative investor. Sometimes crypto assets have the exact same name as their parent blockchain, but with different capitalization. Other times, there's a slightly different name for the asset. For example, the native asset of Bitcoin's blockchain is Bitcoin, small b. The native asset of Ethereum's blockchain is Ether. The native asset of Litecoin's blockchain is Litecoin, small l, etc. Many public blockchains are markedly different from one another. Some members of the early Bitcoin community feel the definition of what makes something a blockchain should be very specific, in particular, that any blockchain must use proof of work as the means of consensus. We disagree with that exclusive worldview, as there are many other interesting consensus mechanisms being developed, such as proof of stake, proof of existence, proof of elapsed time, and so on. Just as machine learning is not just one thing, but composed of the symbolists, connectionists, evolutionaries, Bayesians, and analogizers, so too can blockchain technology have many flavors. In The Master Algorithm, Pedro Domingos hypothesizes that all these camps of machine learning, which at times have been bitter rivals, will one day coalesce. The same will likely be true of blockchain technology. If these distributed databases of value are to be truly transformational, they will have to interoperate and value one another. The many uses of the word blockchain. Despite increased interest in blockchain technology, confusion remains as to what it specifically means due to imprecision in the use of the term. For example, a blockchain, the blockchain, blockchain and blockchain technology can all refer to different things. Typically, when people say the blockchain, they are referring to the original or Bitcoin's blockchain. At the risk of redundancy, but in pursuit of clarity, we will always use Bitcoin's blockchain instead of the blockchain. On the other hand, terms such as a blockchain and blockchain technology typically refer to derivatives of the original that now may have nothing to do with Bitcoin. Meanwhile, blockchain is normally used to refer to the concept itself, with no particular implementation in mind. It is the most amorphous, so our least favored of the terms. Chapter 3. Blockchain, not Bitcoin? In drawing a line between public and private blockchains, we have entered contentious territory that the innovative investor should understand. The difference between these two types of blockchains and the groups that support them is full of tension, because the two camps have different goals for the technology. At the risk of overgeneralizing, private blockchains are backed by incumbents in their respective industries, while public blockchains are backed by the disruptors. To round out the context within which the innovative investor approaches crypto assets, it's important to understand how the world evolved beyond a single blockchain, Bitcoin's blockchain, to include public and private blockchains. Otherwise, investors may be confused when they hear someone claim that Bitcoin is no longer relevant or that it's been displaced. Neither of these claims is true, but it's nonetheless helpful to understand the motivations and rationale behind those that say they are. Bitcoin's early years. We left Bitcoin in Chapter 1 with Satoshi pleading on December 5, 2010, for WikiLeaks not to accept Bitcoin for donations to its site, because Bitcoin was still too young and vulnerable to attack. This was about 2 years after the birth of Bitcoin's blockchain, during which it had lived a mostly quiet and nerdy life. That was all about to change. A few months after Satoshi's plea, a software application was released that would make Bitcoin famous. Launched in February 2011, the Silk Road provided a rules-free decentralized marketplace for any product one could imagine, and it used Bitcoin as the means of payment. You name it, the Silk Road had it. Gawker put it succinctly in a June 2011 article, The Underground Website, where you can buy any drug imaginable. Clearly, this was one way that Bitcoin developed its dark reputation, though it's important to know that this was not endorsed by Bitcoin and its development team. The Silk Road was simply making use of this new digital and decentralized currency by building an application atop its platform. The Gawker article led to the first Google search spike in Bitcoin's life, and would drive the price of Bitcoin from about $10 to $30 in the span of a week. However, the Gawker article jump paled in comparison to the global Google search volume in March to April 2013, which corresponded with a nearly eight-fold increase in price, from roughly $30 to $230 in about a month. The drivers behind this Bitcoin demand were more opaque than the Gawker spike, though many point to the bailout of Cyprus and the associated losses that citizens took on their bank account balances as the core driver. Bitcoin received ample interest for being outside of government control, making its holders immune to such events. Bloomberg ran a story on March 25, 2013, with the eye-catching title, Bitcoin May Be the Global Economy's Last Safe Haven. While the spring of 2013 was notable, it was a preview for Bitcoin's grand opening to global attention. This came 6 months later, in November 2013, when increased demand for Bitcoin in China, along with interest from the U.S. Senate on the innovation, led to a stratospheric ascent through $1,000 that grabbed international headlines. The utility of Google search trends. Google search trends are a useful indicator of what is grabbing mainstream attention. The innovative investor can go to https://trends.google.com/, and explore the patterns of how people are searching for different topics. Google even provides the option to explore search trends by geographical location, giving charts of where interest is spiking, as well as showing what related topics are on the rise. For example, after typing in Bitcoin, investors can look at Google search trends for the last year, or 5 years, or a custom range, and investigate how Nigeria differs from India. We recommend orienting with this tool even beyond crypto assets, as it's a fascinating window into the global mesh of minds. At this point, Bitcoin's spike captured the attention of the People's Bank of China, which promptly implemented restrictions on Bitcoin's use, declaring it was not a currency in the real meaning of the word. The China ruling, combined with the FBI's capture of the creator of the Silk Road, Ross Ulbricht, and soon thereafter the collapse of the biggest exchange at the time, Mt. Gox, put many Bitcoin investors on edge as to its long-term viability in the face of government and law enforcement crackdowns. Bitcoin's subsequent price descent through all of 2014, bottoming in January 2015, was volatile, prolonged, and dispiriting for many early adopters who had been drawn to the new concept. While Bitcoin's price was declining, its developers plowed forward with improving the protocol and building applications atop it. During that time, conversations about the underlying technology gained momentum, as early Bitcoiners emphasized that Bitcoin was important not only because of the decentralized currency aspect, but also because of the architecture that supported it. This emphasis on the technology supporting Bitcoin came about just as a slew of developers and enterprises began to investigate Bitcoin because of the headlines that had grabbed their attention. Clearly, something was going on, and newcomers to the technology were trying to figure out what. The trifecta of current Bitcoiners defending and explaining the disruptive potential of Bitcoin's technology, Bitcoin's price descending dramatically, and newcomers investigating the technology led to a seismic shift in the Bitcoin narrative. Newcomers didn't necessarily see the need for Bitcoin in the ways in which they wanted to use blockchain technology, and they felt reaffirmed in their belief by the continued descent of Bitcoin's price through 2014. But to Bitcoiners, it had always been Bitcoin and blockchain. The asset Bitcoin was what incentivized an ecosystem of players, miners, developers, companies, and users, to secure and build upon Bitcoin's blockchain, delivering means of exchange and store of value services to the world. Out of this examination of the technology underlying Bitcoin, two movements exploded in the blockchain technology space. One was the proliferation of new crypto assets that supported new public blockchains, like Ethereum. These new public blockchains offered utility outside the realm of Bitcoin. For example, Ethereum's goal was to serve as a decentralized world computer, whereas Bitcoin aimed to be a decentralized world currency. This diversity has led to tension among players as some of these crypto assets compete, but this is nothing like the tension that exists between Bitcoin and the second movement. The second movement that exploded on the scene questioned whether Bitcoin, or any crypto asset, was necessary to get the value out of blockchain technology. It is this second movement that we will investigate further in this chapter, as it's important for the innovative investor to understand why some people will claim Bitcoin and other crypto assets aren't needed to keep their implementation secure and functioning. Welcome to the world of private blockchains. Satoshi never said blockchain. The word blockchain was not mentioned once in Satoshi's 2008 white paper. It was early Bitcoin companies that popularized the word within what was then a niche community. For example, blockchain.info, a popular Bitcoin wallet service, was launched in August 2011. Satoshi, on the other hand, frequently referred to the system as a proof-of-work chain. The closest he came to saying blockchain was with phrases such as blocks are chained or a chain of blocks. Since Satoshi only places proof of work directly before chain, many early Bitcoiners are adamant that the term blockchain should only be used if it is proof of work based. Remember that proof of work is a mechanism whereby all the computers building Bitcoin's blockchain remain in sync on how to construct it. Blockchain, not Bitcoin. Articles like one from the Bank of England in the third quarter of 2014 argued, "The key innovation of digital currencies is the distributed ledger, which allows a payment system to operate in an entirely decentralized way, without intermediaries such as banks." In emphasizing the technology and not the native asset, the Bank of England left an open question whether the native asset was needed. At the Inside Bitcoins conference in April 2015, many longtime Bitcoiners commented on how many Wall Street suits were in attendance. While Bitcoin was still king, there were growing whispers of blockchain, not Bitcoin, which was heresy to Bitcoiners. The term blockchain, independent of Bitcoin, began to be used more widely in North America in the fall of 2015, when two prominent financial magazines catalyzed awareness of the concept. First, Bloomberg Markets published an article titled, "Blythe Masters Tells Banks the Blockchain Changes Everything." "The banker who helped give the world credit default swaps wants to upend finance again, this time with the code that powers Bitcoin." In emphasizing the code that powers Bitcoin, this article quietly questioned the need for the native asset, instead emphasizing the underlying technology. Masters was a well-known and respected figure in financial services, one that people associated with financial innovation. Her choice to join a little-known firm at the time called Digital Asset Holdings, after having been the head of global commodities at J.P. Morgan Chase, was reason to believe that blockchain technology was no longer on the fringe of the business world. In the article, a quote from Masters brought everyone to attention. "You should be taking this technology as seriously as you should have been taking the development of the Internet in the early 1990s. It's analogous to email for money." The October 31, 2015 issue of The Economist featured the Trust Machine on its front cover. And while the article tipped its hat to Bitcoin, its focus was the more broadly applicable technology behind Bitcoin, and used the term blockchain throughout. The combination of Masters, Bloomberg, and The Economist led to a spike in interest in blockchain technology that set off a sustained climb in global Google search volumes for blockchain that is still in an upward trend. In the 2 weeks between October 18th and November 1st, 2015, just after Bloomberg and The Economist published their articles, global Google search volumes for blockchain grew 70%. Master's focus for blockchain technology and financial services is on private blockchains, which are very different from Bitcoin's blockchain. Pivotal to the current conversation, private blockchains don't need native assets. Since access to the network is tightly controlled, largely maintaining security through exclusivity, the role of computers supporting the blockchain is different. Since these computers don't have to worry about attack from the outside, they are operating behind a firewall and collaborating with known entities, it removes the need for a native asset that incentivizes the build-out of a robust network of miners. A private blockchain is typically used to expedite and make existing processes more efficient, thereby rewarding the entities that have crafted the software and maintain the computers. In other words, the value creation is in the cost savings, and the entities that own the computers enjoy these savings. The entities don't need to get paid in a native asset as reward for their work, as is the case with public blockchains. On the other hand, for Bitcoin to incentivize a self-selecting group of global volunteers, known as miners, to deploy capital into the mining machines that validate and secure Bitcoin transactions, there needs to be a native asset that can be paid out to the miners for their work. The native asset builds out support for the service from the bottom up in a truly decentralized manner. Public blockchains are not so much databases as they are system architectures spawned from the bottom up to orchestrate the creation of globally decentralized digital services. Over time, miner compensation will shift from the issuance of new Bitcoin to transaction fees, and if global adoption is great enough, then transaction fees will be sufficient to sustain miners. The kernel of belief held by many avid proponents of private blockchains is that the native assets themselves, such as Bitcoin, are irrelevant. They can be removed from the architecture and the best parts of the technology can remain intact. For the use cases these people are pursuing, that's true. For public blockchains, however, it's not true. Enterprises that have come to explore blockchain technology from the perspective of how they can use it to update their current technology stacks, very much in the form of a database, most often fall into the private blockchain bucket. Many financial services companies are the earliest adopters of this mindset. Beyond questioning the need for native crypto assets, which would naturally infuriate communities that very much value their crypto assets, tensions also exist because public blockchain advocates believe the private blockchain movement bastardizes the ethos of blockchain technology. For example, instead of aiming to decentralize and democratize aspects of the existing financial services, Masters Digital Asset Holdings aims to assist existing financial service companies in adopting this new technology, thereby helping the incumbents fight back the rebels who seek to disrupt the status quo. Blockchains as a general-purpose technology. While we have our beliefs about the most exciting applications of blockchain technology, we don't ascribe to an exclusive worldview. Instead, we believe Bitcoin's blockchain is one of the most important blockchains in existence, and that it has given birth to a new general-purpose technology that goes beyond Bitcoin. General-purpose technologies are pervasive, eventually affecting all consumers and companies. They improve over time in line with the deflationary progression of technology, and most important, they are a platform upon which future innovations are built. Some of the more famous examples include steam, electricity, internal combustion engines, and information technology. We would add blockchain technology to this list. While such a claim may appear grand to some, that is the scale of the innovation before us. As a general-purpose technology, blockchain technology includes private blockchains that are going to have a profound impact on many industries, and public blockchains beyond Bitcoin that are growing like gangbusters. The realm of public blockchains and their native assets is most relevant to the innovative investor, as private blockchains have not yielded an entirely new asset class that is investable to the public. Where is blockchain technology in the hype cycle? By now it will be clear to the innovative investor that the blockchain technology space is still working itself out and will continue to do so for years to come. Captivating technologies have a gravitational pull that brings in new minds with varied perspectives and that will push the boundaries of the technology. The progression of a new technology and the way it evolves as it gains mental mindshare is at the core of Gartner's hype cycle for emerging technologies. Gartner is a leading technology research and advisory firm, which displays five common stages of technology. Innovation trigger. Peak of inflated expectations. Trough of disillusionment. Slope of enlightenment. Plateau of productivity. First is the innovation trigger that brings the technology into the world. While not very visible, just as Bitcoin wasn't visible in the early years of its life, word spreads and expectations grow. Over time, the murmurs gain momentum, building into a crescendo that is Gartner's second stage, the peak of inflated expectations. The peak represents the height of confusion around the definition of the original technology, because people often apply it optimistically to everything they see. No technology is a panacea. As companies sprout to life and attempt to transition ideas into reality, shifting from proof of concepts to at-scale implementations, it frequently turns out that implementing a new disruptive technology in the wild is much harder than anticipated. The new technology must integrate with many other systems, often requiring a wide-reaching redesign. It also requires retraining of employees and consumers. These difficulties slowly push the technology into the trough of disillusionment, as people lament that this technology will never work or is too difficult to deal with. When enough people have given up, but the loyal keep working in dedication, the technology begins to rise again, this time not with the irrational exuberance of its early years, but instead with a sustained release of improvements in productivity. Over time, the technology matures, ultimately becoming a steady platform in the plateau of productivity that provides a base on which to build other technologies. While it's hard to predict where blockchain technology currently falls on Gartner's hype cycle, these things are always easier in retrospect, we would posit that Bitcoin is emerging from the trough of disillusionment. At the same time, blockchain technology stripped of native assets, private blockchain, is descending from the peak of inflated expectations, which it reached in the summer of 2016, just before the DAO or DAO hack occurred, which we will discuss in detail in Chapter 5. Crypto assets beyond Bitcoin are at different points between the innovation trigger and the trough of disillusionment. These differ because they came to life at different points after Bitcoin, and many are still emerging. Suffice it to say, the promise is great, the tensions are high, and opportunity awaits the innovative investor. Let's now take a tour of the various crypto assets that currently exist. Chapter 4. The Taxonomy of Crypto Assets. As we've seen, Bitcoin ignited the crypto asset revolution, and its success has led to the birth of numerous other permissionless public blockchains with their own native crypto assets. We also refer to these as Bitcoin's digital siblings. As of March 2017, there were over 800 crypto assets with a fascinating family tree, accruing to a total network value of over $24 billion. At the time, Bitcoin was the largest and most widely transacted of these assets by a wide margin, with a network value of $17 billion, accounting for nearly 70% of the total network value of crypto assets. The next largest crypto asset by network value was Ethereum's Ether, at over $4 billion. Yes, the numbers have changed a lot since. Crypto moves fast. As the investment landscape for crypto assets continues to grow beyond Bitcoin, it's vital for the innovative investor to understand the historical context, categorization, and applicability of these digital siblings, so that potential investment opportunities can be identified. To this end, we aim to provide a historical grounding of who and what led to the creation of many notable crypto assets. Through this process, we will also introduce more detailed concepts that will go into the innovative investor's toolset when investigating future crypto assets. Cryptocurrencies, crypto commodities, and crypto tokens. Historically, crypto assets have most commonly been referred to as cryptocurrencies, which we think confuses new users and constrains the conversation on the future of these assets. We would not classify the majority of crypto assets as currencies, but rather most are either digital commodities, crypto commodities, provisioning raw digital resources, or digital tokens, crypto tokens, provisioning finished digital goods and services. A currency fulfills three well-defined purposes: to serve as a means of exchange, store of value, and unit of account. However, the form of currency itself often has little inherent value. For example, the paper bills in people's wallets have about as little value as the paper in their printer. Instead, they have the illusion of value, which, if shared widely enough by society and endorsed by the government, allows these monetary bills to be used to buy goods and services, to store value for later purchases, and to serve as a metric to price the value of other things. Meanwhile, commodities are wide-ranging and most commonly thought of as raw material building blocks that serve as inputs into finished products. For example, oil, wheat, and copper are all common commodities. However, to assume that a commodity must be physical ignores the overarching offline-to-online transition occurring in every sector of the economy. In an increasingly digital world, it only makes sense that we have digital commodities such as compute power, storage capacity, and network bandwidth. While compute, storage, and bandwidth are not yet widely referred to as commodities, they are building blocks that are arguably just as important as our physical commodities, and when provisioned via a blockchain network, they are most clearly defined as crypto commodities. Beyond cryptocurrencies and crypto commodities, and also provisioned via blockchain networks, are finished product digital goods and services, like media, social networks, games, and more, which are orchestrated by crypto tokens. Just as in the physical world, where currencies and commodities fuel an economy to create finished goods and services, so too in the digital world, the infrastructures provided by cryptocurrencies and crypto commodities are coming together to support the aforementioned finished product digital goods and services. Crypto tokens are in the earliest stage of development, and will likely be the last to gain traction as they require a robust cryptocurrency and crypto commodity infrastructure to be built before they can reliably function. In summation, we believe that a clearer view of this brave new world of blockchain architecture includes cryptocurrencies, crypto commodities, and crypto tokens, just as we have had currencies, commodities, and finished goods and services in the preceding centuries. Be it a currency, commodity, or service, blockchain architectures help provision these digital resources in a distributed and market-based manner. In this chapter, we focus on the most important cryptocurrencies today, including Bitcoin, Litecoin, Ripple, Monero, Dash, and Zcash. The next chapter covers the world of crypto commodities and crypto tokens, the development of which has been accelerated by the launch of Ethereum and its value proposition as a decentralized world computer. Besides its status as the number two crypto asset by network value, Ethereum has also spawned many other crypto assets that creatively utilize its network. While we cannot possibly cover all the crypto assets, we will focus on those we believe will help the innovative investor gain the broadest perspective. To those entrepreneurs and developers who've created assets that we're unable to cover here, we apologize. Many amazing projects were created in the process of writing the book, and if we tried to incorporate them all, the book would never have been finished. To that end, we've included a listing in the resources section to enable access to information on other crypto assets. Why crypto? Sometimes the word crypto makes people shudder, perhaps because they associate it with illicit activity. But that's a mental bias that is important to overcome. Crypto is simply a tip of the hat to and a shortening of the key technology underlying these systems, cryptography. As discussed in Chapter 2, cryptography is the science of securely transmitting data so that only intended recipients can make use of it. Cryptography is used to ensure that crypto assets are transferred to the intended recipient securely. Given our digital world and the increasing prevalence of hacks, the secure transmission of resources is paramount, and crypto assets have such security in spades. The ever-evolving nature of currencies. The pursuit of a decentralized, private, and digital currency predates Bitcoin by decades. Bitcoin and its digital siblings are just part of a broader evolution of currencies that has taken place over centuries. At their inception, currencies were a solution to ease the impreciseness of barter trade, and for centuries, metal coins with material value served as the currencies of choice. Fiat currency was an innovation beyond metal coins, as it was much easier to transport. But the entirety of its value relied upon the government stamp of approval and mandate of legal tender. We believe that currency, void of any physical representation, is the next phase of the evolution, and, in our internet-tethered world, an inevitable one. As innovations underlined the internet gained steam, so too did the realization that we would need a secure form of digital payment. One of Bitcoin's most famous ancestors was pioneered by a company called DigiCash, led by David Chaum, who remains one of the most famous cryptographers in crypto asset history. In 1993, prior to Marc Andreessen founding Netscape, Chaum invented the digital payment system called eCash. This allowed secure and anonymous payments across the internet, no matter the amount. Clearly, Chaum's timing could not have been better given the tech boom that followed through the mid to late 1990s, and his company DigiCash had several opportunities for growth, any of which might have made it a household name. However, while Chaum was widely regarded as a technical genius, as a business person, he left much to be desired. Bill Gates approached Chaum about integrating eCash into Windows 95, which would have immediately given it global distribution. But Chaum refused what was rumored to be a $100 million offer. Similarly, Netscape made initial inquiries about a relationship, but management was quickly turned off by Chaum's attitude. In 1996, Visa wanted to invest $40 million into the company, but were dissuaded when Chaum demanded $75 million. If these reports are correct, it's clear that the potential price for Chaum's creation was dropping. If all had gone well, DigiCash's eCash would have been integrated into all our web browsers at the ground floor, serving as the global internet payment mechanism, and potentially removing the need for credit cards and online payments. Sadly, mismanagement ultimately ran DigiCash into the ground, and in 1998, it declared bankruptcy. While DigiCash failed to become a household name, some players will resurface in our story, such as Nick Szabo, the father of smart contracts, and Zuko Wilcox, the founder of Zcash, both of whom worked at DigiCash for a time. Other attempts were made at digital currencies, payment systems, or stores of value after eCash, like eGold and Karma. The former ran into trouble with the FBI for serving a criminal element, while the latter never gained mainstream adoption. The pursuit of a new form of internet money drew the attention of present-day tech titans such as Peter Thiel and Elon Musk, both of whom had a hand in founding PayPal. Except for Karma, the problem with all these attempts at digital money was that they weren't purely decentralized. One way or another, they relied on a centralized entity, and that presented the opportunity for corruption and weak points for attack. The miracle of Bitcoin. One of the most miraculous aspects of Bitcoin is how it bootstrapped support in a decentralized manner. The importance and difficulty of being the first currency to do so cannot be emphasized enough. Until people understand how Bitcoin works, they often argue that it has no value as currency because, unlike what they're used to, you can't see it, touch it, or smell it. Paper currency has value because it is mutually agreed upon by members of society that it has value. It's much easier for society to agree to this with a government involved. Getting a global society to agree that something has value and can be used as a currency without government support and without a physical form is one of the most significant accomplishments in monetary history. When Bitcoin was launched, it had zero value in the sense that it could be used to purchase nothing. The earliest adopters and supporters subjectively valued Bitcoin because it was a fascinating computer science and game theory experiment. As the utility of Bitcoin's blockchain proved itself a reliable facilitator of Money Over Internet Protocol, MOIP, use cases began to be built using Bitcoin, some of which now include facilitating e-commerce, remittances, and international business-to-business payments. Concurrent with the early development of use cases, investors started to speculate on what future use cases would look like and how much Bitcoin those use cases would require. Together, the combination of current use cases and investors buying Bitcoin based on the expectation for even greater future use cases creates market demand for Bitcoin. How much is a buyer willing to pay for something, the bid, and how much is a seller willing to receive to part with that item, the ask? As with any market, where the bid and ask meet is where the price is set. Mathematically metered supply. One of the keys to supporting Bitcoin's value was its issuance model. Recall from Chapter 2 that miners, the people running the computers building Bitcoin's blockchain, are paid each time they append a block of transactions. They are paid in new Bitcoin created by a Coinbase transaction that is included in each block. For the first 4 years of Bitcoin's life, a Coinbase transaction would issue 50 Bitcoin to the lucky miner. The difficulty of this proof-of-work process was recalibrated automatically every 2 weeks, with the goal of keeping the amount of time between blocks at an average of 10 minutes. In other words, 50 new Bitcoin were released every 10 minutes, and the degree of difficulty was increased or decreased by the Bitcoin software to keep that output time frame intact. In the first year of Bitcoin running, 300 Bitcoin were released per hour, 60 minutes, 10 minutes per block, 50 Bitcoin released per block, 7,200 Bitcoin per day, and 2.6 million Bitcoin per year. Based on our evolutionary past, a key driver for humans to recognize something as valuable is its scarcity. Satoshi knew that he couldn't issue Bitcoin at a rate of 2.6 million per year forever, because it would end up with no scarcity value. Therefore, he decided that every 210,000 blocks, which at one block per 10 minutes takes 4 years, his program would cut in half the amount of Bitcoin issued in Coinbase transactions. This event is known as a block reward halving, or halving for short. On November 28, 2012, the first halving of the block reward from 50 Bitcoin to 25 Bitcoin happened. and the second halving from 25 Bitcoin to 12.5 Bitcoin occurred on July 9, 2016. The third will happen 4 years from that date, in July 2020. Thus far, this has made Bitcoin's supply schedule look somewhat linear. However, when we step back and take a longer-term perspective, Bitcoin's supply trajectory looks anything but linear. In fact, by the end of the 2020s, it will approach a horizontal asymptote, with annual supply inflation less than 0.5%. In other words, Satoshi rewarded early adopters with the most new Bitcoin to get sufficient support, and in so doing, created a big enough base of monetary liquidity for the network to use. He understood that if Bitcoin was a success over time, its dollar value would increase, and therefore, he could decrease the rate of issuance while still rewarding its supporters. Long term, the thinking is that Bitcoin will become so entrenched within the global economy that new Bitcoin will not need to be issued to continue to gain support. At that point, miners will be compensated for processing transactions and securing the network through fees on high transaction volumes. It's common to hear that Bitcoin supply will max out at 21 million units by 2140. This is a function of continuing to divide the units of supply released by a factor of 2 every 4 years. As of January 1, 2017, already 76.6% of Bitcoin supply had been brought into existence. And by the time the next block reward halving happens in 2020, 87.5% of the Bitcoin ever to be minted will be in existence. A few years after 2100, we will reach a supply of 20,999,999 Bitcoin, which is effectively 21 million. It is Bitcoin's scarce supply schedule that makes many think of it as digital gold. The birth of altcoins. Within a couple of years of launching, it had become clear that Bitcoin was the first fully decentralized cryptocurrency to gain significant adoption. But there were some aspects with which people were not fully satisfied. For example, Bitcoin's 10-minute block time meant that, depending on when a consumer hit send, it could take up to 10 minutes, sometimes more, for the transaction to be appended to Bitcoin's blockchain. Often, this delay was more of an issue for the merchant than the consumer, as the merchants needed to know they were getting paid before they could release a good or service. Others worried about Bitcoin's hash function in the proof-of-work process, because hardware was being created that specialized in this hash function and would lead to increased centralization of the mining network. For a decentralized currency, increased centralization of the machines that processed its transactions was concerning. Fortunately, Bitcoin's protocol is open-source software, which meant developers could download the entirety of its source code and tweak the aspects they felt most needed fixing. When the updated software was ready, the developers released it in a manner similar to how Bitcoin was originally released. The new software operated similarly to Bitcoin, but required its own set of developers to maintain it, miners to provide the hardware, and a separate blockchain to keep track of the debits and credits of the new native asset. Through this combination of open-source software and ingenious programmers, many other cryptocurrencies have been brought into existence. Those that are only slight modifications of Bitcoin are often referred to as altcoins. Bitcoin's first digital sibling. Namecoin was the first significant fork away from Bitcoin. Interestingly, it was less about creating a new currency and more about utilizing the immutable nature of the blockchain, a use case we'll address more in the next chapter. A website created with Namecoin comes with the .bit domain, as opposed to the .com domain, and provides security and censorship resistance to those sites registered with it. Namecoin grew out of an idea on the Bitcoin Talk forum in 2010 that focused on BitDNS. DNS stands for Domain Naming Service, which handles all web addresses. In 2013, a service called NameID was released that uses the Namecoin blockchain to enable the creation of and access to websites that have a Namecoin identity. Namecoin acts as its own DNS service and provides users with more control and privacy. As opposed to the typical way in which websites are registered through a government-controlled service such as ICANN, a Namecoin site is registered through a service that exists on each computer on the Namecoin network. This improves security, privacy, and speed. To gain a .bit site, one must have Namecoin to do so, thus the need for the native asset. Litecoin. While a handful of altcoins were released through 2011, Litecoin was the first that would retain significant value to this day. The cryptocurrency was developed by Charlie Lee, an MIT graduate who was a software engineer at Google. When Lee learned of Bitcoin, he quickly understood its power, leading him to mine Bitcoin before trying to create his own variants. After the unsuccessful launch of Fairbricks in September 2011, Lee tried again with Litecoin in October. Litecoin aimed to improve upon Bitcoin in two ways. For one, Litecoin's block times were 2.5 minutes, four times faster than Bitcoin's, which would be important for merchants needing faster confirmation of consumers' payments. Second, Litecoin used a different hash function in the proof-of-work process, also known as a block hashing algorithm, which tried to make the mining process more accessible to hobbyists. To put it into perspective, in the early years of Bitcoin mining, people used central processing units, CPUs, which are the core chips in personal computers, effectively forcing the computers to be used solely for mining purposes. In 2010, people after greater efficiency began using the graphic card, GPU, of an existing computer for the mining process. Many, including Lee, anticipated a shift to yet more dedicated and specialized mining devices called ASICs, application-specific integrated circuits. ASICs required custom manufacturing and specifically designed computers. As a result, Lee correctly foresaw that Bitcoin mining would ramp beyond the reach of hobbyist miners and their homegrown PCs. Lee wanted a coin that retained its peer-to-peer roots and allowed users to be miners without the need for specialized and expensive mining units. Litecoin accomplished this by using a block hashing algorithm called Script, which is memory-intensive and harder for specialized chips like ASICs to gain a significant edge upon. Other than these two tweaks, much of Litecoin remained similar to Bitcoin. The innovative investor will have realized, however, that if blocks are issued four times as fast as Bitcoin, then the total amount of Litecoin released will be four times greater than that of Bitcoin. This is exactly the case, as Litecoin will converge upon a fixed 84 million units, whereas Bitcoin will converge upon a quarter of that, at 21 million units. Lee tweaked the halving characteristics, too, so that a halving occurs at 840,000 blocks, as opposed to Bitcoin's 210,000. This puts Litecoin on a similar yet larger supply trajectory than Bitcoin. Notably, the annual rates of supply inflation are exactly the same for the number of years the cryptocurrency is from launch. It's important to realize that if Bitcoin and Litecoin are both being used in similar size markets, and therefore have the same size network values, a unit of Litecoin will be one-fourth as valuable as a unit of Bitcoin, because there are four times as many units outstanding. This is an important lesson, because all cryptocurrencies differ in their supply schedules, and thus the direct price of each crypto asset should not be compared if trying to ascertain the appreciation potential of the asset. Litecoin's network is often used as a testing ground for Bitcoin software updates, given that Litecoin is nimbler than Bitcoin because it stores a fraction of the monetary value. It has also been used as the basis for other crypto assets. At the start of 2017, Litecoin was the fourth largest crypto asset in terms of network value. Ripple. Ripple is a cryptocurrency created in 2004 by Ryan Fugger, a web developer from Vancouver, British Columbia. Work on the project actually began before Satoshi and Bitcoin, when Fugger was searching for a way to allow communities to create a system of money out of chains of trust.